36, and the outlook for Thursday, increasing cloudiness with a high of 38 degrees, currently 34. And it says on the top of this forecast, actually, courtesy of meteorologist Ed Kieser, happy anniversary, to Live and Local. This is, in fact, our first anniversary program. We started on Groundhog Day in 2009, and so here we go again. Second year, it's been a lot of fun bringing in lots of guests representing all kinds of music, theater, dance, and we've got both music and dance represented on the program today, including Rebecca Nettlefiol and some guests of hers representing February Dance, which is the annual concert by the dance department at the University of Illinois about this time of year. They're performing Thursday through Saturday, 7:30 at the Krannert Center in Urbana. And then later on in the show, Michael Luxner, who's music director of the Millikan Decatur Symphony Orchestra, which is giving its Young Artists Concert, also an annual event. That's on Saturday at the Kirkland Fine Arts Center in Decatur. Stay tuned to this first anniversary edition of Live and Local. I'm Kevin Kelly. That was the opening music to the ballet The Firebird by Igor Stravinsky, which I'm using by way of introduction to both of our guests on the program. Actually, we have several guests, but both of the segments on the show. It is, in fact, going to be the closing piece on the program by the Millikan Decatur Symphony Orchestra on Saturday. It's their Young Artists Concert, which features a number of students at the university who won their annual concerto competition performing with the orchestra on that concert. But it's going to end with a suite from Stravinsky's The Firebird with Michael Luxner conducting, and he'll be my guest later on in Live and Local. And even though University of Illinois does not have a ballet department, so to speak, they do have a dance department, and it is the dance program that is presenting its annual February Dance Concert this weekend, three times, Thursday through Saturday, at 7:30 in the Caldwell Playhouse at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. And my guest is initial guest, Rebecca Nettlefiol, who has brought with her two folks involved in the program. Becky was, for a while, the interim head of the department, and I gather you were glad to have been interim.
Yes. Although it was 4 years of interim.
Yeah, that was a long interim period. And who did you bring with you?
I've brought Kathleen Fisher, who is our guest artist that reconstructed one of the works from the concert, and also she's one of our alums, and also John Tengis, our music director in the Department of Dance.
And before we get to the reason they are both here, because they're connected, well, John is here because he music directs everything that you do, but Kathleen particularly for one piece, which we're going to talk about in a little bit, you have an interest, well, first, the whole February dance thing. That's an annual event.
Yes, it is.
Is this the big one that has all the students involved?
We have actually two big ones. We have November Dance and we have February Dance.
So this is one of them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it has quite a large number of students dancing in the concert. And this year we have three pieces. As you mentioned, we have one piece, Astral Convertible, which is by Tricia Brown. And then and that is an American masterpiece, which we got a large grant to do. And John and Kathleen will talk to you more about that one. And then I have a new piece of my own. And then Renee Wadley, one of our faculty, also has a premiere, a new piece, in which she's dancing, as well as students.
But otherwise, mostly it's the students on the program.
Mostly students,
You
yes.
do have a couple of programs annually that are mostly faculty or graduate students.
We have one annual graduate choreographed concert, and one concert that any student can audition a piece for, and then these other two that I mentioned.
But they're smaller ensemble dances.
Right, right.
Yeah. Well, I've enjoyed these, although it's been, I'm ashamed to say, it's been a while since I've seen one.
Well, time for you to come back.
Apparently so. Well, tell me about your piece, Becky.
Okay. Well, in 2005, Cecilia Bartoli did a concert at Krannert Center, which maybe you were there. I don't know. I was. And it was so fabulous. I think the whole audience was aghast. It was just wonderful. And I loved it. And so I decided to use her singing in my piece. So I've used four selections of works that she sings, and it's a suite of those four pieces.
What did you like about her singing? What blew you away?
Well, her presence was one thing. I mean, just her and her incredible virtuosity and musicality, I think, and her exuberance, because you could just see by the way she performed how much she enjoyed the singing of it.
She looks like she's on speed or something like that. I mean, she just doesn't stand still.
Yeah, it was just incredible.
Bubbly, at the very least.
Yeah.
Bubbling over is kind of what she's like.
Yeah, it's true.
I have a piece here from Vivaldi, her Vivaldi album. So you have some Vivaldi on the concert?
One Vivaldi, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And do we know what this is from, or do I have that in front of me?
You have it in front of you. Better you than me.
Well, let's see. That. I'll probably screw it up. It's the second track on this Vivaldi disc. Dopo un'orrida procella from Griselda. In the character of Ottone. So no, I don't know anything about any of these things. Looking here for the text, just so folks have some idea what she's singing about. After a fearful storm, the calm sky shines clearly and unburdens our hearts of anxiety and fear. Thus destiny deals with us, in turn wounding, then healing. Now, before I play it, when you used this piece, did you have the meaning in mind, or did you mostly go with the sound?
I had read it, obviously, but I didn't try to. No, I mostly went with the sound, not the words so much.
Which, if one doesn't know Italian, actually makes a lot of sense, as yeah. I certainly don't. Well, here's Cecilia Bartoli with the ensemble called Il Giardino Armonico, which is the harmonic garden, here in Live and Local on FM 90.9. That was really typical for Cecilia Bartoli, both in the sound, and you're going to have to imagine somebody who visually looks about like she sounds, with that kind of bubbly energy going on, sort of an incessant energy. And she was singing something from an opera by Vivaldi called Griselda, and the character of Ottone, referring to a storm and then eventually a calm sky, although that never really calmed down, did it?
I don't think so.
She was performing with the group Il Giardino Armonico, the harmonic garden from her disc called the Vivaldi album. And my guest for this portion of the conversation, Rebecca Nettle-Fiol, regarding this week's February dance concert at the University of Illinois at the Krannert Center. And your piece, Becky, what are you calling the piece?
It's called In the Storm of Roses.
And where did you come up with the title?
It's poetic. I mean, it's difficult to come up with titles that kind of encompass the whole flavor, and somehow storm and roses, the two things.
So storm was in that piece.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't really explain it very.
That's not just the name.
That's just the name. And there's something in the end of the piece that I don't really want to give away.
Well, that's
fine. That has
fine.
To do with roses.
And it's very hard to describe visual things anyway on the radio. That's sort of the disadvantage about talking about things like dance and and video and whatnot.
Right.
You commented while we were listening to that as I was showing a couple of the pictures of her in one of these albums where she looks, you know, they really show her exuberance. And you said that you used the photos to stimulate
part
of the process?
In a certain section, actually the very opening, one of the dancers, we looked at those photos and actually used those to invent some of the movement. So,
but you're not going to show the photos.
This is
private inspiration.
Yes.
And we're not showing you people the photos either right now. I mean, we could, but it wouldn't really do us any good.
Wouldn't really work.
To do that. Mm-hmm. When you have music like like this. Do you start with the music and then, you know, definitely put the movements to it? Or did you have any movements in mind?
I had movements in mind. I mean, I know the music I'm using. In this case, I knew the music I was using. But it's not like I turn on the music and try to choreograph it right to the music at the moment. I put it away and work on material, movement material, separately a little bit, and then start to merge them together.
One of the things I'm always curious about choreography is do you notate this stuff, or do you just get it in your brain and then get your dancers together and say, okay, now do this, and then, well, that doesn't work, now do that.
I mean, yeah, more like that. I don't really notate it per se, even though I do know the system Laban notation, which is a notation system.
What do you call it?
Laban notation.
How do you spell that?
Labanotation. Okay. But it isn't something really that I use in process at all. So really it's done in the studio, and the dancers are the ones who remember from one rehearsal to another.
And what if they don't?
But they do. And between the dancers and myself. And then I'll jot down some notes, and maybe we do use video sometimes. So between all of those things. But they're really quite amazing. They can learn and remember.
So what if you want to recreate the piece 5 years from now and all those students have graduated?
That's where the
video
comes.
And you haven't
comes.
Danced it.
Yeah. I think we rely mostly on video nowadays, although it's difficult because it's backwards.
Is the notation used by
It is used
number of
people? A little bit, but not very widely.
Really? Because I've watched a couple of dance pieces created sort of in front of me, and that's how it was, you know, just, okay. It seemed like they were making it up on the spot. I mean, is there a certain amount of that?
In terms of reconstructing?
Well, no, I mean in choreographing in the first place. I mean, you come in with your ideas, and then you see what somebody does, and you either decide that doesn't work. Or...
Sure. Oh, yeah, there's a lot of making it up in rehearsal on the spot, or revising something, or someone does something in a more interesting way than you did, and you like it, and so you capture that, or there's making of material that the dancers also participate in.
So it's really a collaborative creation.
It's definitely collaborative.
And is that true for most choreographers, would you say, or?
I think a lot of people work differently, very often, so.
Watching your colleagues here at the U of I, would you say similar?
My colleagues? I think so. My colleagues, I think, often use dancers as collaborators. Yeah.
I don't think there's really any way for a choreographer to come in with a set repertoire of steps or movements and say, here it is, you do it, without any feedback. There's always some feedback from the living, breathing, dancing body that the choreographer has to take into account.
And that's the voice of John Tengis, who is the music director for the Department of Dance.
Correct.
As long as you've spoken up here.
Right.
What does it mean to be the music director for a dance department? Well, just tell me.
Well, I have a couple of job functions. The primary job that I do is to accompany dance classes, I'd say. And accompany is a word that we music directors of departments of dance don't particularly like. I used to be the president of a group called the International Guild of Musicians in Dance, and we chose that pronoun in rather than for. Precisely because we view our role quite seriously as facilitators of dance, of musicians who actually make choreography audible in a sense. So when I'm playing class, I will see a movement that the instructor has given the class to work on, either an exercise or a dance combination. And then it's up to me to feel that movement inside of me and then to make it audible in a way that the dancers can relate to and can help them to execute the movement well, both physically and also artistically.
So you might be making up some music on the spot.
Well, actually, I don't know if you want to go into this segment of the show right now, but in a sense, well, what I've done, I do that a lot, right? But in this piece, in this show, actually, I've programmed a computer to make up music on the spot in response to the dance.
Well, I guess we've just gone into it. So,
exactly.
And what we're going into is a piece with an interesting, very interesting title, Astral...
Convertible.
Convertible.
Right.
All right. Who wants to explain that, John or
I can start in, and
Kathleen.
Then I'll hand it over to Kathleen. The Department of Dance got a grant called the American Masterpieces Grant to restage a masterpiece of American choreography. And the piece that we put in a grant application to do is called Astral Convertible by Trisha Brown, Trisha Brown Dance Company. Kathleen is a former member of the Trisha Brown Dance Company who danced in this piece quite a bit, right?
Yes, on many occasions.
Yes, so we're thrilled and honored to have Kathleen with us to reconstruct the choreography. The piece was premiered in 1989 and was a pretty early example of what's called interactive dance, in that the motion of the dancers causes, in this case, both the lights and the sound to be triggered, so that lighting changes are triggered, and originally by light bouncing off the dancers' costumes into the set, and the sound would be triggered as well. So I have done a lot of work in interactive dance. My personal art is involved in computer-assisted dance, which means that I will take either video cameras or sensors, in this case, in order to track the motion of dancers. And then through that becomes computer data that is then transformed through various computer algorithms into sound or light or video or various other sort of digital information that is then used as the set or inspiration for the dancers to improvise from, etc. So we've called this a reimagining of Astral Convertible. I believe the official title we're using in this piece is Astral Convertible, reimagined. And so we've tried to use the current resources available in computer technology to really update and in the mission of the university, which is research, to really use it as a springboard for some further research into computers and how they can participate in and assist in choreography. So we've, rather than just using light bouncing into sets for triggers, we're now sensorifying the dancers and trying to interpret their gestures and then using that to tune the music in real time and using it to trigger different lights in this very elaborate, wirelessly controlled set that we have. And I hope you all are getting very intrigued by this out there in radio.
I'm very curious about it. The dancers are wired during the performance?
Well, they're not wired per se. They wear sensors that are tracking their movements in a sense, but they're all wireless. They're very small wireless devices that are then, so that data is then wirelessly transmitted to a central computer that then communicates wirelessly back.
They're wired without wires.
They have small
wires. They're hooked up.
Two or three inch wires.
Right.
Kathleen Fisher was with Trisha Brown, you said, right?
Yes.
And danced this piece. Why don't you talk about what it looked like early, and what do you think, what did you do to it in recreating it?
Okay. Well, when I was with the company, I danced this piece, and it actually has a few incarnations. It has a shorter version that's about 20 minutes long and an extended version that's about 40 minutes long. And I've danced both incarnations with at least three different casts of people around me, bopping around to different roles in it myself. So I've experienced the piece from a lot of perspectives, and I've helped other people learn it also. This is the first time it's been reimagined, and this is the first time it's been done also in at a university in the educational setting. So we had the really fun and kind of daunting job of figuring out what those parameters would be to reimagine it, the dance, and I'll speak to the parameters of the dance. And certainly, in the period of time we have with a group of dancers that while they are trained, they're trained here at the University of Illinois, they're not trained especially for her work. So that's one of the main parameters that I have in setting it, in making choices that will suit the dancers and that will give them an experience similar to, as much as I can make it similar to working with the company and learning a work in the company. I also had a goal of engaging the dancers a little bit in helping to generate the dance. So you talked with Becky a little bit about how she makes material and are the dancers involved. In Trisha's company, we're very much involved. We make the material with Trisha. I didn't do that part with the dances. I took sort of yards and yards of phrases, we call them, and taught the dancers these phrases. And then we tried in a few sections to let them generate their own entrances and exits, which is a pretty technical thing to do when you're already working in, say, a vocabulary, like a new language. Learning her phrases is sort of like learning a new language. I could compare it to that. So we arranged it with what expertise they could find in this new language. And I also kept a lot from the original piece in terms of the order of introducing the materials, even if we wouldn't fully introduce a material or what might be considered a theme in some forms of music. I kept sort of the order that materials got introduced in the original piece. And we borrowed a couple short exact sections from the original piece.
So when you say materials in this case, it's sort of like in music, let's say a Mozart symphony where he has a first theme that he works around with, and then he might have, here's a new theme. And so visually, the first set of material, a viewer would recognize some similarities of movements maybe, or these are themes that they're playing with, and then the next set of materials might be another set of movements?
Yes, and there'll be things in common. Trisha works very much with architecture and geometry in the body, so as you see the different materials introduced, you'll also be just noticing her style and noticing the similarities, even though each material is new, quote-unquote new to the audience until we start repeating it, you'll also see similarities that will, you know, coalesce into a style for you probably.
So you see it both as her style and, in this case, the style of the particular piece.
Yes.
So both of those things going on.
Yes.
So this music that I have a clip of, John.
Yes.
Would you like to introduce it in some
sure.
way?
I've taken a couple of minutes from each sort of segment of the piece. We, in Kathleen's teaching of the piece, we divided it sort of in rehearsal. It's a very sort of seamless piece. It doesn't really have movements or sections or anything like that. But we, while rehearsing it, sort of broke it up into little sections that we worked with, and I organized the sounds in a similar way. So I just sort of took a sample of various bits of the dance. The way the music is constructed, there are basic chords, I guess, that you'll hear that form sort of the sonic bed of the piece. And those chords do respond to the dancers in terms of how in tune or out of tune they are. And then also over that, you'll hear different samples that I've recorded. Some of the samples come from synthesizers that I played. Some of them, actually, one of our favorite one comes from, at one point, the towers were making little weird electronic noises, and I sampled that and put
the
that
towers.
Into. Right, sorry. The set is comprised of 8 what are called towers. They're metal rectangular shapes that hold the speakers that make the sound, and they also hold the lights that light the set. So the lights don't come from the regular proscenium lighting. All the lighting comes from these little, what we call, towers. And so at one point the lights were making little popping noises, so I sampled those and put those into the mix. That's, I guess, enough of an introduction to.
So does this have any relationship to the music that was used in, you know, when Trisha Brown's piece, when originally?
No, other than that he is working with a random element, and he's working with something that is triggered from the towers.
So the towers.
The music is reimagined also.
But the towers belong to the piece initially.
The towers are reimagined.
They're also reimagined.
The towers are reimagined. The lighting as it comes off the towers. The piece was originally lit by the towers and conceived of as a site-specific piece, meaning it wouldn't have to be done on the proscenium stage with the lighting that is available there. So within that parameter, the piece is reimagined.
Right.
In every way, pretty much.
Right. When we
first spoke with Trisha
Brown. When we first spoke with Trisha Brown, her she said that we had to have the towers in the same dimension that they originally were created, and that we adhere to a minimalist aesthetic, and thirdly, that we honor the spirit of Bob Rauschenberg, who was the original designer of the set. That, of course, is a large spirit and open to a lot of interpretation. But the original score was by a fellow named Richard Landry, and then later on John Cage contributed a score, and so now I'm the third sound artist to contribute a score to this piece. And it does have a relation in that it's informed by the Cage piece and also does have the same sort of structure in that the dancers will trigger things. You'll hear something sound for a while, and then it subsides, and there's silence in between various sonic events.
Okay, so does the music itself have a name, or we just call it the music for Astral Convertible?
We call it the music for Astral Convertible Reimagined.
More or less by John Tengis.
More.
More.
Yes.
Almost entirely.
Almost entirely.
Okay.
Yes.
And so we'll hear some of this. This is for the production by University of Illinois Dance of Illinois series, I guess you call it, according to this note here. And it's the February Dance Concert this Thursday through Saturday at the Krannert Center. And I'm with Rebecca Nettle-Fiol of the dance department, Kathleen Fisher, who is an alum, who has reimagined this piece, John Tengis, who is the music director for the dance program and composer of this music on Live and Local on FM 90.9. So you have some kind of an idea of some of the sounds that will happen maybe or probably not in that order during the performance of Tricia Brown's piece Astral Convertible, which is being reimagined by Kathleen Fisher and the dancers and John Tengis's music and whatever happens as triggered by the wireless wires that the dancers are going to be hooked up to during the February dance program. Is that kind of about right?
That's about right.
Sure. So on this program, in addition to Astral Convertible and Becky Nettle-Fiol's piece based on Cecilia Bartoli's singing, we also have one by Renee Wadley on faculty, which she's helping to dance.
She's also dancing in it, which is a rare occasion.
For her to dance?
Mm-hmm.
Really? So
yeah.
This will be a treat.
Yeah, it will be a treat.
That's
we
great.
Also have some other guest dancers coming, one alum and a former student. And so we have some guest dancers and some student dancers in that piece.
And, you know, it's might as well mention again that this is our first anniversary program. We started Live and Local on the 2nd of February last year. And, Becky, you reminded me that something that I'd completely forgotten, and so this is purely by chance, that you were, I think, the second guest. I think you were on the second or third day of the show.
Yeah, I didn't know it at the time.
And here you are again. It just worked out. I mean, just the way it happened.
Yeah.
Of course, I guess February Dance happens.
That's why, because I was concert director.
Early in February.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that year and this year I'm also concert director.
Well, I'm glad you could be here on this special day.
Me too.
And so we've expanded the musical offerings here to include some electronica, which I think we haven't had before. And we will just continue expanding.
What's odd is that I started my professional musical career as a harpsichordist.
Did you really?
So I've come quite a way in my
career. Well, I think we probably have some harpsichord in this this next little clip of Cecilia Bartoli. This is music by, let's see, we're doing track number 5 from her CD that was represented by the concert that she did at the Krannert Center a few years ago. This is music by Caldara from an opera of his, an aria di Flavia, it says here, Cecilia Bartoli, and we'll go out with her a little bit. And thank you all for coming in today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you.
February Dance is Thursday through Saturday at the Krannert Center, 7:30 each evening. For more information, krannertcenter.com. Coming up, Michael Luxner, a conductor of the Millikan Decatur Symphony Orchestra, about this weekend's Young Artists Concert. And it's worth saying at this moment that support for our broadcast today is provided by the Metropolitan Opera, continuing its series of live opera in high definition at neighborhood theaters. On Saturday, February 6th, the Met presents Verdi's Simone Boccanegra, with James Levine conducting and featuring Plácido Domingo. More information is online at metopera.org. My guest for this portion of the program on Live and Local is Michael Luxner, who is music director of the Millikan Decatur Symphony Orchestra in Decatur at Millikan University, logically enough, and he also is professor of music at the university there and has been a fairly frequent guest on Live and Local. And, you know, Michael, this is our first anniversary program.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
In fact, I thought I heard Vic DiGeronimo this morning say that isn't tomorrow his anniversary?
Yes, it is. We started both his program, which is called The Morning Express, and Live and Local on the same day. Yeah.
Bunch of groundhogs over at that stage.
I don't think we meant to do it quite that with that in mind, but that's how it happened.
Anyway. Good time of year for you. I enjoy everyone on that station
and your
shows as well.
We thank you very much. And, of course, you're here today because the MDSO is doing its annual Young Artists Concert this Saturday, 7:30 in the evening.
Yeah, 7:30.
Kirkland Fine Arts Center,
and the box office number there is 424-6318.
Or Kirkland, what is it, millikan.edu/Kirkland.
Just something go to Millikan, like that. And I don't know, run a search on Kirkland. I forget.
Well, it's easy to find.
Millikan, and it's easy to get in.
Millikan.edu. So this is indeed a concert you've been doing annually for quite a while.
Right. Well, since before I joined the faculty as well, like most institutions of higher learning with strong music schools, there's an annual competition here. It's called the Concerto Aria Competition, and a certain number of students earn from winning this competition the chance to perform with the orchestra, and you yourself have judged that competition, so you know what the kind of soloists we get. And I must say, this concert's always a little bit of a knuckle biter, I guess, because we go into the very end of the calendar year, not of course knowing what's going to be on the concert, and you start thinking, okay, I've got to worry about my budget and get my music and all that. But this year, we had a particularly wonderful balance of repertoire as a result of who won. We have all four of the traditional media represented. We have a wind player, a string player, a percussionist, and a vocalist. And a very nicely balanced repertoire. Turned out that we have arias from Europe, we have concerto from North America, a concerto from South America, and a concerto from Asia.
And then a little Stravinsky that the orchestra is doing on its own.
Yeah, we programmed the Firebird Suite. We always program some, at least one major repertoire piece just for the orchestra for this concert, so that, well, we have something to hang everything else around and, of course, maintain our own standards and have something to advertise that we know about before the season starts. So.
I was struck in looking at the list of winners by a couple of things. One is that, since you mentioned that I have judged that competition a few times, it seems that just about every year there is a vocalist and a marimba player.
I not quite. I would say certainly every year there is probably a vocalist and sometimes more than one vocalist, because Millikan is very strong in the vocal choral area. In fact, of our 300 some majors, 60% are usually vocal. So there's always going to be more singers than any other kind of instrument. And the marimbas, They do, you're right. They do win not every year, but out of proportion to their numbers here. It's a very strong studio, and the teachers Jeremy Brunk and Brian Justison seem to know exactly what students are right for which piece. And there's interesting repertoire, and they always memorize. They're always right on top of it. And yeah, you're right. When they're in there, they often win.
And the
in
other,
fact, this, I'm sorry to interrupt, but sure. I just realized this particular piece we're doing this year, the Rosauro Concerto. This is the third time I've done this piece in doing this concert for 13 years, and in doing my research, I discovered that it is probably the most played marimba concerto globally in history ever.
What's this? The first name?
The composer?
Yeah.
Ney Rosauro, N E Y.
From?
Well, his roots are. I hope I'm not wrong. I'm pretty sure he's Brazilian. I know he's from South America somewhere, but he spent large chunks of his career in North America. In fact, he taught at a university in Florida for quite a while. So I think he's fairly Americanized or naturalized. But yes, this piece does draw on Latin American rhythms and really, really explores the timbres of the instrument with great subtlety and variety.
The other thing that struck me on this year's program is that there is a violinist. In the years I judged, it always seemed that there weren't so many string players even in the competition.
Well, that's true. It's I have a theory about that. Is that it's harder for the performers on standard repertoire instruments. The instruments that we traditionally associate with the most solo opportunities, pianists, violinists, because the repertoire is so well known to the judges, and we've all grown up hearing these standard repertoire pieces for mainstream instruments played by, the greatest performers in history. And so whatever weaknesses might be there, and there will be some in undergraduates, tend to stand out more rather than in repertoire that is unusual and where one doesn't know if what may be amiss. Wind players, percussionists, tend to play more 20th century repertoire, which has its own theatricality, and you may have less experience to judge it against. So it's one always wonders about these things and can only hope that over the years, given good, fair, open-minded judging, that all worthy musicians will get their opportunities one way or another. But yes, you're actually right. This is only the second violinist on this concert since I've been doing it.
Oh, really? That few. Well, and she's playing one of my favorite pieces.
Isn't it gorgeous?
Opening movement of Samuel Barber's concerto.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. What I wrote, I had about one line of program in which to write a note for this, so I simply called it a masterpiece of 20th century lyricism and among the finest concertos ever written in the United States, and I'll stand by that.
Yeah, no kidding.
Just that one opening melody. I mean, he didn't have to do much more than that, but it's not just a gorgeous, long-breathed melody. Once you get to know the piece, and this is my first time working on it, just its transformations are really very subtle. He really plays, essentially a lyrical content into a form which one associates not with so much with melodies, but with motives. And yet, because it can mutate and turn left here and turn right there, it works beautifully. Negotiating around the curves of the architecture of the form, and it just soars for the whole time. Just a beautiful, beautiful work. And I also discovered, by the way, that its world premiere was almost to the day of the day we're performing it. It was first played on February 7th in 1941.
Thank you.
That was the opening portion of the first movement of the Concerto for Violin and Orchestra by American composer Samuel Barber. And the anniversary of that first performance of that piece coming up on the 7th of February. In this performance, you heard violinist Gil Shaham with conductor Andre Previn and the London Symphony Orchestra. And you can hear that first movement played live by violinist Rachel Edwards, who is a student at Millikan University in Decatur, on the Millikan Decatur Symphony Orchestra Young Artist Concert on Saturday, the 6th of February. My guest on this portion of the program is Michael Luxner, music director of the orchestra. And on that program also, soprano Callie Zindel playing music, singing music by Weber, Handel, and Strauss. Marimba player Laura Benson in Ney Rosaro's Marimba Concerto. And then the remaining one, a trumpet concerto that is, well, there's not all that many famous trumpet concertos, and I guess this is one of three or four.
Yeah, probably. There aren't many. We trumpet players probably know more than the rest of you, but when it comes to the ones that you hear in public, this is right up there, certainly with the classical standbys, the Hummel and the Haydn. It's probably the best-known piece by Aretunian. He was... and I believe he's still alive, by the way.
Oh, is he really?
Yeah, I cannot find a date of death for him, so I hope I'm not wrong here. I don't want to say that reports of his longevity are greatly exaggerated, but he would be about 90, 91 by now, and appears to still be alive. And this piece is from 1950. He's Armenian, and of course did most of his work during the period when Armenia was part of the Soviet Union, and he managed to pull it off by writing music that was pleasing and well received to the authoritarian state, and had a very successful career, and yet at the same time never compromised on interest or sonority or architecture. And this is a one movement piece that seems to roll together all the elements you might expect from a complete concerto. It has development, it has aggressive themes, it has lyrical themes, it has reflective section, it has a cadenza, it has a brilliant end. So and again, this is only the second trumpet player, by the way, we've had win this competition.
Really? Wow.
Since I've been doing it, and both times on this piece.
And it's a great year for Millikan soloists.
It is for me. I'm having a terrific time on this concert. We're really, really enjoying ourselves.
Some wonderful music. So Johnny Dwyer is the one we haven't mentioned. He's playing the Aretunian trumpet.
Yeah, did you
concerto.
Call him Johnny? I just noticed.
That's what it says in the program you sent me.
Oh, really? Okay. I meant because for the official formal program, we changed it to John.
Ah.
And yet everyone here knows him as Johnny, and I thought, well, maybe, gosh, you just sensed that. But I guess I sent you an
You wrote it down. You wrote it down.
Okay.
Well, Michael Luxner, my guest here on Live and Local, regarding Millikan Decatur Symphony Orchestra's Young Artists Concert, the annual event. It's this Saturday evening at 7:30 at the Kirkland Fine Arts Center on the campus of Millikan University in Decatur. And I appreciate your joining us on the program.
Always a pleasure, sir.
Trumpet Concerto of Alexander Aretunian in a performance here by Arturo Sandoval. And he is with the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Luis Haza. And that's one of the pieces you can hear on the concert by the Millikan Decatur Symphony Orchestra, their Young Artist Concert. John Dwyer will be the soloist Saturday at 7:30 at the Kirkland Fine Arts Center. And in fact, the Millikan Decatur Symphony Orchestra will be on Prairie Performances this Thursday evening, hosted by Roger Cooper on our evening concert. That's at 8 o'clock Thursday night. Solomon Bear is clarinet soloist for two works, as well as Scheherazade's Rimsky-Korsakov Scheherazade on that program. Support for our program today comes in part from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods on the corner of 6th and University in Champaign. providing Champaign-Urbana with an international selection of chocolates, cheeses, oils, balsamic vinegar, jams, spices, barbecue sauces, and more. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio. Some other events in our area, the weekly session of Irish traditional music is at Bentley's Pub in downtown Champaign tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. Donnie Heitler plays solo jazz piano in Urbana at the Great Impasta. That's Wednesday night at 6. Composer Philip Bloom gives a concert of his own chamber music tomorrow night at 7:30 at the Krannert Center in Urbana. Nonsense 2, The Second Coming, is at Parkland Theater starting Thursday at 7:30 and running through the weekend. Well, I guess they started last week, running through the weekend and next. And the Pacifica Quartet are in recital Thursday evening at 7:30 at the Krannert Center in Urbana. And the Pacifica Quartet will be appearing live in our studio on tomorrow's edition of Live and Local. That is at noon. I'm Kevin Kelly, host of the show, and thanks for joining us on this first anniversary program of Live and Local. Coming up, news headlines, and then Julie Amacher is back. She's got music for you right after the news at 106. It's going to be a cloudy afternoon with a high of 36 degrees. Tonight, mostly cloudy, the low 22. Tomorrow, partly to mostly sunny with a high of 36. Thursday, increasingly cloudy with a high of 38 degrees. Currently 34. This is WYL FM and HD Urbana, operating translators W293 AF Danville and W266 AF Urbana.